is a green ribbon along the river, edging the dark red desolation of the desert. It is a proverb, and one of vast antiquity, that it is created by the mysterious bounty and almost sinister benevolence of the Nile. When we first hear of Egyptians, they are living as in a string of riverside villages, in small and separate but cooperative communities along the bank of the Nile. Where the river branched into the broad delta, there was traditionally the beginning of a somewhat different district or people. But this need not complicate the main truth. These more or less independent, though interdependent, peoples were considerably civilized already. They had a sort of heraldry, that is, decorative art used for symbolic and social purposes, each sailing the Nile under its own ensign, representing some bird or animal. Heraldry involves two things of enormous importance to normal humanity, the combination of the two making that noble thing called cooperation, on which rest all peasantries and peoples that are free. The art of heraldry means independence, an image chosen by the imagination to express the individuality. The science of heraldry means interdependence, an agreement between different bodies to recognize different images, a science of imagery. We have here, therefore, exactly that compromise of cooperation between free families or groups, which is the most normal mode of life for humanity, and is particularly apparent wherever men own their own land and live on it. With the very mention of the image of bird and beast, the student of mythology will murmur the word totem almost in his sleep. But, to my mind, much of the trouble arises from his habit of saying such words as if in his sleep. Throughout this rough outline, I have made a necessarily inadequate attempt to keep on the inside rather than the outside of such things, to consider them, where possible, in terms of thought, and not merely in terms of terminology. There is very little value in talking about totems unless we have some feeling of what it really felt like to have a totem. Granted that they had totems and we have no totems, was it because they had more fear of animals or more familiarity with animals? Did a man whose totem was a wolf feel like a werewolf, or like a man running away from a werewolf? Did he feel like Uncle Remus about Brer Wolf, or like St. Francis about his brother the wolf, or like Mowgli about his brothers the wolves? Was a totem a thing like the British lion, or a thing like the British bulldog? Was the worship of a totem like the feeling of Africans about Mumbo Jumbo, or of children about Jumbo? I have never read any book of folklore, however learned, that gave me any light upon this question, which I think by far the most important one. I will confine myself to repeating that the earliest Egyptian communities had a common understanding about the images that stood for their individual states, and that this amount of communication is prehistoric, in the sense that it is already there at the beginning of history. But as history unfolds itself, this question of communication is clearly the main question of these riverside communities. With the need for communication comes the need of a common government, and the growing greatness and spreading shadow of the king. The other binding force besides the king, and perhaps older than the king, is the priesthood. And the priesthood has, presumably, even more to do with these ritual symbols and signals by which men can communicate. And here in Egypt arose probably the primary and certainly the typical invention to which we owe all history, and the whole difference between the historic and the prehistoric, the archetypal script, the art of writing. The popular pictures of these primeval empires are not half so popular as they might be. There is shed over them the shadow of an exaggerated gloom, more than the normal and even healthy sadness of heathen men. It is part of the same sort of secret pessimism that loves to make primitive man a crawling creature, whose body is filth and whose soul is fear. It comes, of course, from the fact that men are moved most by their religion, especially when it is irreligion. For them, anything primary and elemental must be evil. But it is the curious consequence that while we have been deluged with the wildest experiments in primitive romance, they have all missed the real romance of being primitive. They have described scenes that are wholly imaginary, in which the men of the Stone Age are men of stone, like walking statues, in which the Assyrians or Egyptians are as stiff or as painted as their most archaic art. But none of these makers of imaginary scenes have tried to imagine what it must really have been like to see those things as fresh, which we see as familiar. They have not seen a man discovering fire like a child discovering fireworks. They have not seen a man playing with the wonderful invention called the wheel like a boy playing at putting up a wireless station. They have never put the spirit of youth into their descriptions of the youth of the world. It follows that amid all their primitive or prehistoric fancies, there are no jokes. There are not even practical jokes in connection with the practical inventions. And this is very sharply defined in the particular case of hieroglyphics, for there seems to be serious indication that the whole high human art of scripture or writing began with a joke. There are some who will learn with regret that it seems to have begun with a pun. The king or the priests or some responsible persons, wishing to send a message up the river in that inconveniently long and narrow territory, hit on the idea of sending it in picture writing, like that of the Red Indian. Like most people who have written picture writing for fun, he found the words did not always fit. But when the word for taxes sounded rather like the word for pig, he boldly put down a pig as a bad pun, and chanced it. So a modern hieroglyphist might represent at once by unscrupulously drawing a hat followed by a series of upright numerals. It was good enough for the pharaohs and ought to be good enough for him. But it must have been great fun to write or even to read these messages when writing and reading were really a new thing. And if people must write romances about ancient Egypt, and it seems that neither prayers nor tears nor curses can withhold them from the habit, I suggest that scenes like this would really remind us that the ancient Egyptians were human beings. I suggest that somebody should describe the scene of the great monarch sitting among his priests, and all of them roaring with laughter and bubbling over with suggestions as the royal puns grew more and more wild and indefensible. There might be another scene of almost equal excitement about the decoding of this cipher, the guesses and clues and discoveries having all the popular thrill of a detective story. That is how primitive romance and primitive history really ought to be written. For whatever was the quality of the religious or moral life of remote times, and it was probably much more human than is conventionally supposed, the scientific interest of such a time must have been intense. Words must have been more wonderful than wireless telegraphy, and experiments with common things a series of electric shocks. We are still waiting for somebody to write a lively story of primitive life. The point is, in some sense, a parenthesis here, but it is connected with the general matter of political development, by the institution which was most active in these first and most fascinating of all the fairy tales of science. It is admitted that we owe most of this science to the priests. Modern writers like Mr. Wells cannot be accused of any weakness of sympathy with a pontifical hierarchy. But they agree, at least, in recognizing what pagan priesthoods did for the arts and sciences. Among the more ignorant of the enlightened, there was indeed a convention of saying that priests had obstructed progress in all ages. And a politician once told me in a debate that I was resisting modern reforms exactly as some ancient priest probably resisted the discovery of wheels. I pointed out in reply that it was far more likely that the ancient priest made the discovery of the wheels. It is overwhelmingly probable that the ancient priest had a great deal to do with the discovery of the art of writing. It is obvious enough in the fact that the very word hieroglyphic is akin to the word hierarchy. The religion of these priests was apparently a more or less tangled polytheism of a type that is more particularly described elsewhere. It passed through a period when it cooperated with the king, another period when it was temporarily destroyed by the king, who happened to be a prince with a private theism of his own, and a third period when it practically destroyed the king and ruled in its stead. But the world has to thank it for many things which it considers common and necessary, and the creators of those common things ought really to have a place among the heroes of humanity. If we were at rest in a real paganism, instead of being restless in a rather irrational reaction from Christianity, we might pay some sort of pagan honor to these nameless makers of mankind. We might have veiled statues of the man who first found fire, or the man who first made a boat, or the man who first tamed a horse. And if we brought them garlands or sacrifices, there would be more sense in it than in disfiguring our cities with cockney statues of stale politicians and philanthropists. But one of the strange marks of the strength of Christianity is that since it came, no pagan in our civilization has been able to be really human. The point is here, however, that the Egyptian government, whether pontifical or royal, found it more and more necessary to establish communication. And there always went with communication a certain element of coercion. It is not necessarily an indefensible thing that the state grew more despotic as it grew more civilized. It is arguable that it had to grow more despotic in order to grow more civilized. That is the argument for autocracy in every age, and the interest lies in seeing it illustrated in the earliest age. But it is emphatically not true that it was most despotic in the earliest age and grew more liberal in a later age. The practical process of history is exactly the reverse. It is not true that the tribe began in the extreme of terror of the old man and his seat and spear. It is probable, at least in Egypt, that the old man was rather a new man, armed to attack new conditions. His spear grew longer and longer, and his throne rose higher and higher, as Egypt rose into a complex and complete civilization. That is what I mean by saying that the history of the Egyptian territory is in this the history of the earth, and directly denies the vulgar assumption that terrorism can only come at the beginning and cannot come at the end. We do not know what was the very first condition of the more or less feudal amalgam of landowners, peasants, and slaves in the little commonwealths beside the Nile, but it may have been a peasantry of an even more popular sort. What we do know is that it was by experience and education that little commonwealths lose their liberty, that absolute sovereignty is in something not merely ancient, but rather relatively modern. And it is at the end of the path called progress that men return to the king. Egypt exhibits, in that brief record of its remotest beginnings, the primary problem of liberty and civilization. It is the fact that men actually lose variety by complexity. We have not solved the problem properly any more than they did, but it vulgarizes the human dignity of the problem itself to suggest that even tyranny has no motive save in tribal terror. And just as the Egyptian example refutes the fallacy about despotism and civilization, so does the Babylonian example refute the fallacy about civilization and barbarism. Babylon, also, we first hear of when it is already civilized, for the simple reason that we cannot hear of anything until it is educated enough to talk. It talks to us in what is called cuneiform, that strange and stiff triangular symbolism that contrasts with the picturesque alphabet of Egypt. However relatively rigid Egyptian art may be, there is always something different from the Babylonian spirit, which was too rigid to have any art. There was always a living grace in the lines of the lotus, and something of rapidity as well as rigidity in the movement of the arrows and the birds. Perhaps there is something of the restrained but living curve of the river, which makes us, in talking of the serpent of old Nile, almost think of the Nile as a serpent. Babylon was a civilization of diagrams rather than of drawings. Mr. W. B. Yeats, who has a historical imagination to match his mythological imagination, and indeed the former is impossible without the latter, wrote truly of the men who watched the stars from their pedantic Babylon. The cuneiform was cut upon bricks, of which all their architecture was built up. The bricks were of baked mud, and perhaps the material had something in it forbidding the sense of form to develop in sculpture or relief. Theirs was a static but a scientific civilization, far advanced in the machinery of life and in some ways highly modern. It is said that they had much of the modern cult of the higher spinsterhood, and recognized an official class of independent working women. There is perhaps something in that mighty stronghold of hardened mud that suggests the utilitarian activity of a huge hive. But though it was huge, it was human. We see many of the same social problems as in ancient Egypt or modern England. And whatever its evils, this also was one of the earliest masterpieces of man. It stood, of course, in the triangle formed by the almost legendary rivers of Tigris and Euphrates, and the vast agriculture of its empire, on which its towns depended, was perfected by a highly scientific system of canals. It had, by tradition, a high intellectual life, though rather philosophic than artistic. And there preside over its primal foundation those figures who have come to stand for the star-gazing wisdom of antiquity, the teachers of Abraham, the Chaldees. Against this solid society, as against some vast bare wall of brick, there surged, age after age, the nameless armies of the nomads. They came out of the deserts, where the nomadic life had been lived from the beginning, and where it is still lived today. It is needless to dwell on the nature of that life. It was obvious enough, and even easy enough, to follow a herd or a flock, which generally found its own grazing ground, and to live on the milk or meat it provided. Nor is there any reason to doubt that this habit of life could give almost every human thing except a home. Many such shepherds or herdsmen may have talked in the earliest time of all the truths and enigmas of the book of Job. And of these were Abraham and his children, who have given to the modern world for an endless enigma the almost monomaniac monotheism of the Jews. But they were a wild people without comprehension of complex social organization, and a spirit like the wind within them made them wage war on it again and again. The history of Babylonia is largely the history of its defense against the desert hordes, who came on at intervals of a century or two, and generally retreated as they came. Some say that an admixture of nomad invasion built at Nineveh the arrogant kingdom of the Assyrians, who carved great monsters upon their temples, bearded bulls with wings like cherubim, and who sent forth many military conquerors who stamped the world as if with such colossal hooves. Assyria was an imperial interlude, but it was an interlude. The main story of all that land is the war between the wandering peoples and the state that was truly static. Presumably in prehistoric times, and certainly in historic times, those wanderers went westward to waste whatever they could find. The last time they came, they found Babylon vanished. But that was in historic times, and the name of their leader was Muhammad. Now, it is worthwhile to pause upon that story, because, as has been suggested, it directly contradicts the impression still current that nomadism is merely a prehistoric thing, and social settlement a comparatively recent thing. There is nothing to show that the Babylonians had ever wandered. There is very little to show that the tribes of the desert ever settled down. Indeed, it is probable that this notion of a nomadic stage followed by a static stage has already been abandoned by the sincere and genuine scholars to whose researches we all owe so much. But I am not at issue in this book with sincere and genuine scholars, but with a vast and vague public opinion which has been prematurely spread from certain imperfect investigations, and which has made fashionable a false notion of the whole history of humanity. It is the whole vague notion that a monkey evolved into a man, and in the same way a barbarian evolved into a civilized man, and therefore at every stage we have to look back to barbarism and forward to civilization. Unfortunately, this notion is, in a double sense, entirely in the air. It is an atmosphere in which men live rather than a thesis which they defend. Men in that mood are more easily answered by objects than by theories, and it will be well if anyone tempted to make that assumption in some trivial turn of talk or writing can be checked for a moment by shutting his eyes and seeing for an instant, vast and vaguely crowded like a populous precipice, the wonder of the Babylonian Wall. One fact does certainly fall across us like its shadow. Our glimpses of both these early empires show that the first domestic relation had been complicated by something which was less human, but was often regarded as equally domestic. The dark giant called slavery had been called up like a genie and was laboring on gigantic works of brick and stone. Here again, we must not too easily assume that what was backward was barbaric. In the matter of manumission, the earlier servitude seems in some ways more liberal than the later, and perhaps more liberal than the servitude of the future. To ensure food for humanity by forcing part of it to work was, after all, a very human expedient, which is why it will probably be tried again. But in one sense, there is a significance in the old slavery. It stands for one fundamental fact about all antiquity before Christ, something to be assumed from first to last. It is the insignificance of the individual before the state. It was as true of the most democratic city-state in Hellas as of any despotism in Babylon. It is one of the signs of this spirit that a whole class of individuals could be insignificant or even invisible. It must be normal, because it was needed for what would now be called social service. Somebody said, "The man is nothing and the work is all," meaning it for a breezy Carlisle and commonplace. It was the sinister motto of the heathen servile state. In that sense, there is truth in the traditional vision of vast pillars and pyramids going up under those everlasting skies, forever, by the labor of numberless and nameless men, toiling like ants and dying like flies, wiped out by the work of their own hands. But there are two other reasons for beginning with the two fixed points of Egypt and Babylon. For one thing, they are fixed in tradition as the types of antiquity, and history without tradition is dead. Babylon is still the burden of a nursery rhyme, and Egypt, with its enormous population of princesses awaiting reincarnation, is still the topic of an unnecessary number of novels. But a tradition is generally a truth, so long as the tradition is sufficiently popular, even if it is almost vulgar. And there is a significance in this Babylonian and Egyptian element in nursery rhymes and novels. Even the newspapers, normally so much behind the times, have already got as far as the reign of Tutankhamun. The first reason is full of the common sense of popular legend. It is the simple fact that we do know more of these traditional things than of other contemporary things, and that we always did. All travelers, from Herodotus to Lord Carnarvon, follow this route. Scientific speculations of today do indeed spread out a map of the whole primitive world, with streams of racial emigration or admixture marked in dotted lines everywhere, over spaces which the unscientific medieval map maker would have been content to call terra incognita, if he did not fill the inviting blank with a picture of a dragon to indicate the probable reception given to pilgrims. But these speculations are only speculations at the best, and at the worst, the dotted lines can be far more fabulous than the dragon. There is, unfortunately, one fallacy here into which it is very easy for men to fall, even those who are most intelligent, and perhaps especially those who are most imaginative. It is the fallacy of suppositing that because an idea is greater in the sense of larger, therefore it is greater in the sense of more fundamental and fixed and certain. If a man lives alone in a straw hut in the middle of Tibet, he may be told that he is living in the Chinese Empire, and the Chinese Empire is certainly a splendid and spacious and impressive thing. Or, alternatively, he may be told he is living in the British Empire, and be duly impressed. But the curious thing is that in certain mental states, he can feel much more certain about the Chinese Empire that he cannot see than about the straw hut that he can see. He has some strange magical juggle in his mind by which his argument begins with the empire, though his experience begins with the hut. Sometimes he goes mad and appears to be proving that a straw hut cannot exist in the domains of the Dragon Throne, that it is impossible for such a civilization as he enjoys to contain such a hovel as he inhabits. But his insanity arises from the intellectual slip of supposing that, because China is a large and all-embracing hypothesis, therefore it is something more than a hypothesis. Now, modern people are perpetually arguing in this way, and they extend it to things much less real and certain than the Chinese Empire. They seem to forget, for instance, that a man is not even certain of the solar system as he is certain of the South Downs. The solar system is a deduction, and doubtless a true deduction, but the point is that it is a very vast and far-reaching deduction, and therefore he forgets that it is a deduction at all, and treats it as a first principle. He might discover that the whole calculation is a miscalculation, and the sun and stars and street lamps would look exactly the same. But he has forgotten that it is a calculation, and is almost ready to contradict the sun if it does not fit into the solar system. If this is a fallacy, even in the case of facts pretty well ascertained, such as the solar system and the Chinese Empire, it is an even more devastating fallacy in connection with theories and other things that are not really ascertained at all. Thus, history, especially prehistoric history, has a horrible habit of beginning with certain generalizations about races. I will not describe the disorder and misery this inversion has produced in modern politics, because the race is vaguely supposed to have produced the nation. Men talk as if the nation were something vaguer than the race, because they have themselves invented a reason to explain a result. They almost deny the result in order to justify the reason. They first treat a Celt as an axiom, and then treat an Irishman as an inference. And then they are surprised that a great fighting, roaring Irishman is angry at being treated as an inference. They cannot see that the Irish are Irish, whether or not they are Celtic, whether or not there ever were any Celts. And what misleads them once more is the size of the theory, the sense that the fancy is bigger than the fact. A great scattered Celtic race is supposed to contain the Irish, so of course the Irish must depend for their very existence upon it. The same confusion, of course, has eliminated the English and the Germans by swamping them in the Teutonic race. And some tried to prove from the races being at one that the nations could not be at war. But I only give these vulgar and hackneyed examples in passing, as more familiar examples of the fallacy. The matter at issue here is not its application to these modern things, but rather to the most ancient things. But the more remote and unrecorded was the racial problem, the more fixed was this curious inverted certainty in the Victorian man of science. To this day, it gives a man of those scientific traditions the same sort of shock to question these things, which were only the last inferences when he turned them into first principles. He is still more certain that he is an Aryan, even than that he is an Anglo-Saxon, just as he is more certain that he is an Anglo-Saxon than that he is an Englishman. He has never really discovered that he is a European, but he has never doubted that he is an Indo-European. These Victorian theories have shifted a great deal in their shape and scope, but this habit of a rapid hardening of a hypothesis into a theory, and of a theory into an assumption, has hardly yet gone out of fashion. People cannot easily get rid of the mental confusion of feeling that the foundations of history must surely be secure, that the first steps must be safe, that the biggest generalization must be obvious. But though the contradiction may seem to them a paradox, this is the very contrary of the truth. It is the large thing that is secret and invisible. It is the small thing that is evident and enormous. Every race on the face of the earth has been the subject of these speculations, and it is impossible even to suggest an outline of the subject. But if we take the European race alone, its history, or rather its prehistory, has undergone many retrospective revolutions in the short period of my own lifetime. It used to be called the Caucasian race, and I read in childhood an account of its collision with the Mongolian race. It was written by Bret Harte and opened with the query, "Or is the Caucasian played out?" Apparently the Caucasian was played out, for in a very short time he had been turned into the Indo-European man, sometimes, I regret to say, proudly presented as the Indo-Germanic man. It seems that the Hindu and the German have similar words for mother or father. There were other similarities between Sanskrit and various Western tongues. And with that, all superficial differences between a Hindu and a German seemed suddenly to disappear. Generally, this composite person was more conveniently described as the Aryan, and the really important point was that he had marched westward out of those highlands of India, where fragments of his language could still be found. When I read this as a child, I had the fancy that, after all, the Aryan need not have marched westward and left his language behind him. He might also have marched eastward and taken his language with him. If I were to read it now, I should content myself with confessing my ignorance of the whole matter. But as a matter of fact, I have great difficulty in reading it now, because it is not being written now. It looks as if the Aryan is also played out. Anyhow, he has not merely changed his name, but changed his address, his starting place, and his route of travel. One new theory maintains that our race did not come to its present home from the east, but from the south. Some say that the Europeans did not come from Asia, but from Africa. Some have even had the wild idea that the Europeans came from Europe, or rather, that they never left it. Then there is a certain amount of evidence of a more or less prehistoric pressure from the north, such as that which seems to have brought the Greeks to inherit the Cretan culture, and so often brought the Gauls over the hills into the fields in Italy. But I merely mention this example of European ethnology to point out that the learned have pretty well boxed the compass by this time, and that I, who am not one of the learned, cannot pretend for a moment to decide where such doctors disagree. But I can use my own common sense, and I sometimes fancy that theirs is a little rusty from want of use. The first act of common sense is to recognize the difference between a cloud and a mountain. And I will affirm that nobody knows any of these things in the sense that we all know of the existence of the pyramids of Egypt. The truth, it may be repeated, is that what we really see, as distinct from what we may reasonably guess, in this earliest phase of history, is darkness covering the earth, and great darkness the peoples, with a light or two gleaming here or there on chance patches of humanity, and that two of these flames do burn upon two of these tall primeval towns, upon the high terraces of Babylon and the huge pyramids of the Nile. There are indeed other ancient lights, or lights that may be conjectured to be very ancient, in very remote parts of that vast wilderness of night. Far away to the east, there is a high civilization of vast antiquity in China. There are the remains of civilizations in Mexico and South America and other places, some of them apparently so high in civilization as to have reached the most refined forms of devil worship. But the difference lies in the element old tradition. The tradition of these lost cultures has been broken off, and though the tradition of China still lives, it is doubtful whether we know anything about it. Moreover, a man trying to measure the Chinese antiquity has to use Chinese traditions of measurement, and he has a strange sensation of having passed into another world under other laws of time and space. Time is telescoped outwards, and centuries assume the slow and stiff movement of eons. The white man trying to see it as the yellow man sees feels as if his head were turning round and wonders wildly whether it is growing a pigtail. Anyhow, he cannot take, in a scientific sense, that queer perspective that leads up to the primeval pagoda of the first of the sons of heaven. He is the real Antipodes, the only true alternative world to Christendom, and he is, after a fashion, walking upside down. I have spoken of the medieval map-maker and his dragon. But what medieval traveler, however much interested in monsters, would expect to find a country where a dragon is a benevolent and amiable being? Of the more serious side of Chinese tradition, something will be said in another connection. But I am only talking of tradition and the test of antiquity. And I only mention China as an antiquity that is not for us reached by a bridge of old tradition, and Babylon and Egypt as antiquities that are. Herodotus is a human being in a sense in which a Chinaman in a billycock hat, sitting opposite to us in a London tea shop, is hardly human. Chesterton is saying he's like an alien from another planet. We feel as if we knew what David and Isaiah felt like, in a way in which we never were quite certain what Li Hung Chang felt like. The very sins that snatched away Helen or Bathsheba have passed into a proverb of private human weakness, of pathos, and even of pardon. The very virtues of the Chinaman have about them something terrifying. This is the difference made by the destruction or preservation of a continuous historical inheritance, as from ancient Egypt to modern Europe. But when we ask what was that world that we inherit, and why those particular people and places seem to belong to it, we are led to the central fact of civilized history. That center was the Mediterranean, which was not so much a piece of water as a world. But it was a world with something of the character of such a water, for it became more and more a place of unification in which the streams of strange and very diverse cultures met. The Nile and the Tiber alike flow into the Mediterranean. So did the Egyptian and the Etrurian alike contribute to a Mediterranean civilization. The glamour of the great sea spread indeed very far inland, and the unity was felt among the Arabs alone in the deserts, and the Gauls beyond the northern hills. But the gradual building up of a common culture running round all the coasts of this inner sea is the main business of antiquity. As will be seen, it was sometimes a bad business, as well as a good business. In that orbis terrarum, or circle of lands, there were the extremes of evil and of piety. There were contrasted races and still more contrasted religions. It was the scene of an endless struggle between Asia and Europe, from the night of the Persian ships at Salamis to the flight of the Turkish ships at Lepanto. It was the scene, as will be more especially suggested later, of a supreme spiritual struggle between the two types of paganism, confronting each other in the Latin and the Phoenician cities, in the Roman Forum and the Punic Mart. It was the world of war and peace, the world of good and evil, the world of all that matters most. With all respect to the Aztecs and the Mongols of the Far East, they did not matter as the Mediterranean tradition mattered, and still matters. Between it and the Far East, there were, of course, interesting cults and conquests of various kinds, more or less in touch with it, and in proportion as they were, so intelligible also to us. The Persians came riding in to make an end of Babylon, and we are told in a Greek story how these barbarians learned to draw the bow and tell the truth. Alexander the great Greek marched with his Macedonians into the sunrise, and brought back strange birds colored like the sunrise clouds, and strange flowers and jewels from the gardens and treasuries of nameless kings. Islam went eastward into that world and made it partly imaginable to us, precisely because Islam itself was born in that circle of lands that fringed our own ancient and ancestral sea. In the Middle Ages, the empire of the Mughals increased its majesty without losing its mystery. The Tartars conquered China, and the Chinese apparently took very little notice of them. All these things are interesting in themselves, but it is impossible to shift the center of gravity to the inland spaces of Asia from the inland sea of Europe. When all is said, if there were nothing in the world but what was said and done and written and built in the lands lying round the Mediterranean, it would still be, in all, the most vital and valuable things of the world in which we live. When that southern culture spread to the northwest, it produced many very wonderful things, of which doubtless we are ourselves the most wonderful. When it spread thence to colonies and new countries, it was still the same culture, so long as it was culture at all. But round that little sea like a lake were the things themselves, apart from all extensions and echoes and commentaries on the things, the Republic and the Church, the Bible and the heroic epics, Islam and Israel and the memories of the lost empires, Aristotle and the measure of all things. It is because the first light upon this world is really light, the daylight in which we are still walking today, and not merely the doubtful visitation of strange stars, that I have begun here with noting where that light first falls on the towered cities of the eastern Mediterranean. But though Babylon and Egypt have thus a sort of first claim in the very fact of being familiar and traditional, fascinating riddles to us, but also fascinating riddles to our fathers, we must not imagine that they were the only old civilizations on the southern sea, or that all the civilization was merely Sumerian, or Semitic, or Coptic, still less merely Asiatic or African. Real research is more and more exalting the ancient civilization of Europe, and especially of what we may still vaguely call the Greeks. It must be understood in the sense that there were Greeks before the Greeks, as in so many of their mythologies, there were gods before the gods. The island of Crete was the center of the civilization now called Minoan, after the Minos, who lingered in ancient legend, and whose labyrinth was actually discovered by modern archaeology. This elaborate European society, with its harbors and its drainage and its domestic machinery, seems to have gone down before some invasion of its northern neighbors, who made or inherited the Hellas we know in history. But that earlier period did not pass till it had given to the world gifts so great that the world has ever since been striving in vain to repay them, if only by plagiarism. Somewhere along the Ionian coast, opposite Crete and the islands, was a town of some sort, probably of the sort that we should call a village or hamlet, with a wall. It was called Ilion, but it came to be called Troy, and the name will never perish from the earth. A poet, who may have been a beggar and a balladmonger, who may have been unable to read and write, and was described by tradition as blind, composed a poem about the Greeks going to war with this town to recover the most beautiful woman in the world. That the most beautiful woman in the world lived in that one little town sounds like a legend. That the most beautiful poem in the world was written by somebody who knew of nothing larger than such little towns is a historical fact. It is said that the poem came at the end of the period, that the primitive culture brought it forth in its decay, in which case one would like to have seen that culture in its prime. But anyhow, it is true that this, which is our first poem, might very well be our last poem, too. It might well be the last word as well as the first word spoken by man about his mortal lot as seen by merely mortal vision. If the world becomes pagan and perishes, the last man left alive would do well to quote the Iliad and die. But in this one great human revelation of antiquity, there is another element of great historical importance, which has hardly, I think, been given its proper place in history. The poet has so conceived the poem that his sympathies apparently, and those of his reader certainly, are on the side of the vanquished rather than of the victor. And this is a sentiment which increases in the poetical tradition, even as the poetical origin itself recedes. Achilles had some status as a sort of demigod in pagan times, but he disappears altogether in late times. But Hector grows greater as the ages pass, and it is his name that is the name of a knight of the Round Table, and his sword that legend puts into the hand of Roland, laying about him with the weapon of the defeated Hector in the last ruin and splendor of his own defeat. The name anticipates all the defeats through which our race and religion were to pass. That survival of 100 defeats, that is its triumph. The tale of the end of Troy shall have no ending, for it is lifted up forever into living echoes, immortal as our hopelessness and our hope. Troy's standing was a small thing that may have stood nameless for ages, but Troy falling has been caught up in a flame and suspended in an immortal instant of annihilation. And because it was destroyed with fire, the fire shall never be destroyed. And as with the city, so with the hero. Traced in archaic lines in that primeval twilight is found the first figure of the knight. There is a prophetic coincidence in his title. We have spoken of the word chivalry and how it seems to mingle the horseman with the horse. It is almost anticipated ages before in the thunder of the Homeric hexameter and that long leaping word with which the Iliad ends. It is that very unity for which we can find no name but the holy centaur of chivalry. But there are other reasons for giving in this glimpse of antiquity the name upon the sacred town. The sanctity of such towns ran like a fire round the coasts and islands of the northern Mediterranean, the high-fenced hamlet for which heroes died. From the smallness of the city came the greatness of the citizen. Hellas, with her 100 statues, produced nothing statelier than that walking statue, the ideal of the self-commanding man. Hellas of the 100 statues was one legend and literature, and all that labyrinth of little-walled nations resounding with the lament of Troy. A later legend, an afterthought but not an accident, said that stragglers from Troy founded a republic on the Italian shore. It was true in spirit that republican virtue had such a root, a mystery of honor that was not born of Babylon or the Egyptian pride. There shone like the shield of Hector, defying Asia and Africa, till the light of a new day was loosened with the rushing of the eagles and the coming of the name that came like a thunderclap when the world woke to Rome. End of chapter 3.